From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Some may wonder whether prison can actually rehabilitate felons. We'll look at the statewide statistics and then tell you about a program that is offering a way out to ex-cons and the story of one ex-con who's turned his life around as a result.
BNSF Railway, moving our economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. A key goal of prison is rehabilitation. And if released, we want those folks not to recommit crimes at a later date. Recently, there's been a dramatic shift in policy away from the way we treat criminals, more on a focus on rehabilitation instead of a focus on punishment. The question is, what impact has this public policy shift had on those involved in the most serious crimes, felons? Has it made them more or less likely to reoffend? Our guest is Justin Goss with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, who recently authored a report that attempts to answer that very question. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, first, it's helpful to define what is recidivism. We hear that word a lot. How is it measured?
Yeah, recidivism is a broad swath of reoffending behavior. We define it in our study in four different ways to try to capture the umbrella term that's usually used. So we follow offenders from 2011 to 2015 and track them for 2 years after they're released from a period of incarceration or start a period of supervision, like probation.
Right.
And we measure it in terms of rearrest for any offense right. after being convicted of a prior offense. Rearrest for a felony offense in particular, reconviction for any offense, or reconviction for a felony offense.
Yeah, and
I think
it's a really important point. I want to underscore that because people might have missed what you were saying there, and that is there's a difference between rearrest and reconviction, right? You could be arrested but found innocent or not found guilty. And then we'll talk about more of that in a moment, but I want to make sure people understand the difference between rearrest and reconviction. They're different things.
Certainly.
So, okay, historically, California, how's it done in recidivism rates compared to other states?
So historically, California's recidivism rates have been higher than some of its comparable neighbors. But we'll get into a little bit later how those comparisons are a little bit challenging to make apples to apples comparisons
right.
between.
Right.
But historically, California, in the decade leading up to 2011, when we passed a major criminal justice reform, about two-thirds of all offenders were returned to prison after having been released.
And some of those
were
because
prison.
Of parole violations. We'll talk about that.
That's true. There are multiple ways to return to prison.
Right. And by the way, another thing that I've learned as I'm reading this stuff is there's a difference between prison and jail. State prison, county
yes.
jail.
Absolutely.
Yeah, people kind of mix those terms together sometimes. And I was looking at your report compared to New York, just to give you a kind of a juxtaposition.
Sure.
New York, 43%.
Correct.
Texas, 36%. Florida, 25%. So we had higher rates going into this.
That's true. Folks were returning to prison at higher rates than how those states typically define recidivism.
Right, and that changed, and we'll talk about that after 2011. Mm-hmm. So there were several major criminal justice reforms that occurred in the past decade. Can you describe the most consequential?
Let me talk about two there. So first, in 2011, there was what's now referred to as public safety realignment, where in response to the United States Supreme Court holding that California's prisons were overcrowded, the governor and the legislature acted to reduce the prison population, reduce overcrowding, without having to build more prisons, which would
be... And they were really, really overcrowded. It wasn't just a few people. It was like 50, 60, 70% more than they're supposed to have capacity.
That's true. If you want to put a number on it, the Supreme Court ordered California to reduce its prison population to 137.5% of rated capacity.
So still 37.5% above capacity.
That is true.
But they were way beyond that.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes. And so realignment, what it did was it caused this mass transfer, and I'm glad that you talked about state prison versus county jail, mm-hmm. because it caused a mass realignment of supervision of offenders from state prison to county jail. And those folks who were ineligible to be realigned were those who had serious violent or sex-related criminal histories. And so what it did was it concentrated some of these more serious offenders in state prisons right. and then changed supervision status for a much broader swath of offenders to the county.
Yeah, and then the question also is, which is not necessarily something I want to get into in much detail, but county jails were not necessarily designed for this population, right? And so all of a sudden you're shifting all these people to county jails that really weren't ready for it in some ways. So that's another issue. I do want to ask you about, you know, these reforms are not without controversy. I mean, people, their proponents, their opponents, proponents of these things, you know, the three strikes group thought you'd be tough on crime versus this was a different approach to crime. What have been some of the arguments?
The second reform that really caused a significant amount of controversy came after realignment, 2014, with Proposition 47, which reclassified some property and drug offenses from felonies to misdemeanors.
The three nons, right? Was nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual.
Well, so that again was realignment. Those were the folks who were able to be realigned from state prison to county jail. Prop 47 targeted just a few lower-level drug and property offenses and changed their classification from felonies to misdemeanors. And the controversy that you speak of, so proponents argued that incarceration is costly and doesn't really do much to improve rehabilitation outcomes. And they point to the high recidivism rates or return to prison rates that you touched on earlier to say that it's not really working and the taxpayers aren't getting their money's worth. Opponents argue that reducing incarceration spells and shortening the sentences takes away a key deterrent for offenders and also possibly threatens public safety.
Okay, well, you know, measuring recidivism is a little more complicated than you might think. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Justin Goss with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California about a report recently he authored entitled Recidivism of Felony Offenders in California. So you state in your report that, quote, recidivism is notoriously hard to measure, unquote. Why?
There's a couple reasons, but let me talk about the main one that we talk about in the report, which is that recidivism is a proxy for reoffending behavior, and it tends to be a little bit over-inclusive and under-inclusive, where it's over-inclusive in the sense that past research has shown that ex-offenders under more stringent supervision might commit minor technical violations that are then detected more easily.
Yeah, because they're being watched.
Exactly, right. And as a result, that ends up showing up as recidivism where it might not have ordinarily. The other thing is a little bit easier to imagine where it's under-inclusive, where recidivism can only be detected if law enforcement in some way detects that reoffending behavior. So you can imagine that someone could be released from a period of incarceration, go on to reoffend, but then there's no arrest, and so we don't observe it in the data.
Right, right. It all depends on the numbers, what's being collected. So you also state in your report that it's now difficult, keyword is now, to compare California's recidivism rates with those of other states. Why?
There's also a couple of reasons for that. On the one hand, we've been talking about multiple measures of recidivism, and so it's always been challenging because certain states might define recidivism differently, where, for instance, prior to realignment, California defined recidivism as return to prison rate, where since most folks were being supervised by the state prisons, they would leave state prisons, and if they reoffended, they would come back to state prison. Mm-hmm. But after realignment, that definition needed to change because most offenders were no longer being supervised by state prison. So now California uses the three-year reconviction rate for offenses to measure recidivism.
Right. And can you give us an overview on felony offenders who were released? How many were being released from prison or jail? How many were on probation? Get an idea of that?
In our data, so we have data from 12 of the state's counties that comprise 300,000 felony offenders who were released between October 2011 and October 2015.
Pretty good sample size.
Yeah, it makes up about 60%. Those 12 counties account for 60% of California's offender population. And so among those, what we saw were that 34% were released from a period of being sentenced to jail followed by probation. Mm-hmm. About a third were sentenced to prison. About a quarter came from a period of only probation, and about 1 in 10 served just a period of jail with no probation.
So kind of give an idea what the felony population looks like. So you mentioned that releases varied across different sentencing groups. Can you explain that?
Yes. What we saw was that as time moves further away from public safety realignment in 2011, there's a gradual decrease in the number of releases from state prison, which makes sense because
the population is smaller.
Exactly. Fewer offenders are going to prison, fewer offenders are coming out. And then we also saw a gradual increase in the number of offenders being sentenced to jail with no probation because that was a creation of realignment known as straight sentencing, where you could be sentenced to jail with no probation tail.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the straight sentencing was about. Thank you for clarifying that in advance of my asking the question. So let's talk about demographics and criminal histories. Do you see any patterns among felony offenders?
Yeah. In the 300,000 offenders that are in our data, the average age was 34 years old. Mm-hmm. 84%, so the vast majority, male.
So 80% are male. But I want to get back to that number 34. I noticed that in your report. But you also said the first conviction was at 24.
That is true. Yeah. And the average number of prior arrests was 15.
Wow.
That's
a frequent flyer, as it were.
That's one way to refer to them.
Right.
Yeah. Other things that we saw along racial ethnic lines, a quarter of them were African American, a little less than a third were white, and 4 in 10 were Latino.
So that doesn't match up necessarily with the general population, right? Some of those statistics are higher than the general population.
That's true. Historically, what we see in California's prisons and jails is that African Americans tend to be overrepresented, Latinos tend to be somewhat overrepresented, and whites tend to be underrepresented relative to their numbers in the population. In terms of criminal histories, which you also asked about 1 in 5 of these offenders were serving an offense for an offense against another person.
Which could be a violent offense.
A violent or nonviolent.
Right,
certain
right.
nonviolent
but it,
offenses.
But it could be violent. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. And about a third were for a drug offense, and a little more than a quarter were for a property offense.
Yeah, like burglary, things of that nature.
Exactly.
So, okay, how do those characteristics change over time as the criminal justice reforms were implemented?
What we saw over time is that as we get further away from realignment, the population tends to get a little bit older. The population is a little bit more likely to be male. The population is a little bit less likely to be white. And post Prop 47, as we talked about before, which changed certain drug offenses from felonies to misdemeanors,
right,
the likelihood that someone was serving a sentence for a drug offense decreased.
Okay. Well, up next, how often are ex-felons rearrested after they're released, and how often do those arrests lead to new convictions? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Justin Goss, an expert in the criminal justice system with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, about recidivism rates for ex-felons after release. So, what types of crimes are being committed by ex-felons?
Well, so we tracked reoffending behavior over time, over the period of 4 years, October 2011 to October 2015, and followed reoffense behavior for a period of 2 years after they were released from incarceration.
And we're talking about rearrest as well as reconviction.
That's right. So, just to recap, we measure recidivism along four lines: rearrest for any offense,
right,
rearrest for felony offenses, reconviction. So you're.
I was giving a summary, but yes, in more detail. Yeah, in terms of arrest rates for felons overall, et cetera.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, reconviction and then reconviction for a felony offense. And what we found overall is that rearrests declined during this period by 3%, which we would say is a relatively small decrease, but a significant one. The felony rearrest rate for offenders declined by 5% during the period. The reconviction rate declined by 15%, so a larger amount, and the felony reconviction rate declined by 27%, which is quite substantial.
Yeah, and I was looking at the thing, it says, if I understand this correctly, the overall rearrest rate for crimes against persons, which could include violent crimes, increased by 5%, and felony rearrest rate also rose by 7%, and I'm just wondering, for those folks who are saying, we're getting soft on crime, do these statistics prove that removing the threat of prison, kind of de-emphasizing punishment, is emboldening criminals?
Not necessarily. That is a hypothesis. A change in criminal behavior in response to these criminal justice reforms, that is an interpretation of the data, but we can't actually say that for sure. It's also important to contextualize that finding a little bit and say that reconvictions for offenses against persons, which, as you said, includes violent offenses, but also includes nonviolent offenses, such as stalking or harassment.
Okay.
Reconvictions stayed mostly flat during this period. The other thing, just to contextualize it a little bit more for the audience, is that there was an increase, that 5% increase in rearrest for offenses against persons represented only a 1 percentage point increase in rearrest rates from 19% to 20%.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
5% is actually a relatively small increase.
Right, yeah, 1% overall. So let me ask you this, recidivism rates when it comes to property crimes, what'd you find there?
For property crimes, what we found is that there was significant fluctuation where rates increased a little bit as we got further away from realignment, but then fell as we got further away from realignment and then declined after Prop 47. Ultimately, what we found is that the overall rearrest rate for property offenses stayed about the same over the period of the entirety of the data, and that we observed a small decline in felony rearrest rates for property offenses by about 4%. So 4% lower start to finish.
A little bit lower.
And then reconvictions followed about the same pattern. Overall reconvictions for property offenses stayed about the same.
I think some people were worried that, you know, that maybe people with drug offenses or whatever are going to go out and cause property crimes. But that's not, the data is not really showing that.
Not in terms of property offenses. No, okay. Not when we look over the full course of those 4 years of our data.
Well, let's talk about drug offenses. What are the recidivism rates for drug offenses?
Drug offenses, we saw significant changes following particularly Proposition 47. So over the full period of the data, and most of these changes we think are partially attributable at least to Proposition 47, which again took misdemeanor drug offenses took felony drug offenses and reclassified them as misdemeanor drug offenses. So you had fewer folks serving longer sentences for these drug offenses. So what we saw is that rearrest rates for drug offenses declined by 9% during the data. So relatively large amount.
Okay.
But even more so for felony rearrests for drug offenses, they fell by 44%.
Wow, that's a big number.
Large number.
That's a very large number.
But not quite as large as the felony reconviction rate for drug offenses, which fell by 69%.
Wow.
But again, we would expect to see this just because offenses that folks were being arrested for are no longer felonies.
Right, instead, they're reclassifying.
Instead, they're misdemeanors.
Yeah,
exactly.
Wow, but those are tremendous drops. What about offenses like DUI and possession of a weapon, those recidivism rates in that area?
This was a little bit more of a mixed bag in terms of what we saw, where the rearrest rate for these other offenses, like you said, DUIs or possession of a weapon, they declined by 8% start to finish. But the felony rearrest rate increased slightly by 9%. And then the overall reconviction rate for these offenses rose by 6%, and the felony reconviction rate increased by 9%.
Okay, so a bit of a mixed bag.
Excuse me, 13%.
A mixed bag is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. So what conclusions can you draw from all these findings?
It's always a little bit difficult to get to the bottom of what's causing these changes in reoffending behavior. What we can say for sure is that these criminal justice reforms happened, and then we did not see substantial increases in reoffending
behavior.
Which
was a concern of a lot of people.
Absolutely, yeah. Opponents were concerned, perhaps fairly, that these criminal justice reforms, and as you said, realigning folks from state prison supervision to county jail and probation supervision, where the counties were initially unused to supervising certain types of offenders, people were concerned as to what that would do to the public safety, but we did not see substantial increases in reoffending behavior.
Yeah, it seems like they're working it out as they go along. Well, up next, some recommendations on how we can reduce recidivism even more. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Justin Goss, an expert in recidivism with the nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, about recidivism rates among ex-felons who've been released since California passed a series of criminal justice reforms over the last decade. In short, has California's attempt at criminal justice reform increased or decreased recidivism among ex-felons? So, felons have been released and then reconvicted. Did you observe any patterns based if they served their sentences in prison, state prison, or locally in a county jail or probation?
What we found was pretty interesting, where So we were able to compare the outcomes for folks being released from prison to folks being released from a period of just jail supervision, jail and probation, or probation only. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that the group sentenced to jail only had lower rearrest and reconviction rates than the group sentenced to prison.
Mm-hmm.
What we found for the probation and jail and probation groups, a little bit more of a mixed bag. In both cases, we found higher rates of rearrest, but lower rates of both reconviction and felony reconviction.
So they're being watched, but maybe not convicted. So that's easier to arrest them, but maybe not convict them.
Exactly. It ties back to what we were talking about with recidivism sometimes being over-inclusive, where their behavior, it's being detected, but then ultimately either the DA decides not to file charges or in something in the law enforcement, it does not rise to the level
of reconviction. That's a really, really good point because it depends a lot on the DA's, their discretion about whether or not they want to prosecute certain crimes and go after certain people. And so that impacts recidivism rates from location to location.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this. What kinds of offenses were these people later convicted of?
Right. So we broke down the specific types of offenses that if a person did recidivate, what type of offense they were most likely to have reoffended with. So uh, if a person reoffended and it was for an offense against a person, so a violent offense, an offense against a person, they were most likely to have come from the prison or jail group. Compared to if a person reoffended and it was for a property offense, they were most likely to have come from the jail group in particular, more so than any of the other groups. And then lastly, if it was for a drug offense, it was most likely that the person was being supervised by probation only.
Yeah, and that kind of makes sense. I mean, it sounds like the prison population is a little bit, frankly, hardcore and more serious crimes.
And that's
where those folks are coming from. So were there any trends you noticed by the type of offense? I mean, was there an increase and decrease, for example, in drug and property crimes?
Yeah. Overall, we found that...
It declined a little bit, didn't it?
We found that offenses against persons increased a little bit, that offenses, reconvictions for offenses for property offenses decreased slightly during the period, and then rearrests and reconvictions for drug offenses during the period declined substantially.
Okay. So overall, was there an increase, like getting right down to brass tacks here, was there an increase or decrease in rearrest rates first?
Overall, we found a small decrease, about 3%, in rearrest rates overall. We found a somewhat larger, about 9% in terms of rearrests for felonies in particular. And then we found larger decreases in reconvictions, both for overall offenses and felony offenses.
So that's some good news. There's a decline there. So that seems to be good news. So why are those rates then, why are they declining? Does this prove that California's attempt at criminal justice reform might actually be working?
It depends on what you think the goal of criminal justice reform was. So in the beginning of this, we talked about how the state was motivated by the Supreme Court decision to uncrowd the prisons and reduce overcrowding.
And it was also a budget issue too, right?
Because exactly.
It was expensive to house these folks, and we're going through a recession. The state needed money. And how expensive is it approximately to house someone in state prison?
I believe the Legislative Analyst's Office, when they last estimated it, put it somewhere between $50,000 and $60,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of money when you think about that.
It is quite expensive. And so if that was the goal, to reduce overcrowding in prisons without substantially raising incarceration costs while also not threatening public safety, it seems like the reforms have been a success. Because as we talked about, the reforms have occurred and we haven't seen substantial increases in reoffending behavior.
No big spec. So let me ask you this, kind of from a different perspective. Is there any evidence to show that more severe sanctions or higher criminal penalties resulted in better or lower recidivism rates?
Not exactly. Other research, and our research was consistent with this, shows that there's not a strong statistical link between reoffending behavior and the severity or length of a sentence. And we sort of got into that when we talked about comparing the groups to the outcomes with the prison group, where offenders sentenced to prison in our data, they were supervised for an average of 980 days, so nearly 3 years. And compare that to the group that was supervised in jail, they were supervised for an average of 256 days. Those sentenced to jail and probation, 71 days. And like we talked about, those offenders sentenced to jail and probation actually had lower reconviction
outcomes.
Which is kind
of, that is really interesting. To repeat that again, they had lower outcomes than
the probation and jail and probation group had higher rearrests but lower reconviction outcomes.
Reconviction is the kind of that seemed to be the important one.
Sure, and like we've talked about, there's a number of factors, so we can't say for sure that this is a change in offending behavior, but it is possible that as we got further away from realignment, the resources accruing to counties allowed them to better supervise their offenders.
Well, that's a lot of information you gave us, Justin. I appreciate your being with us, Justin Goss with the Public Policy Institute of California.
What about local attempts to reduce recidivism? Are they working? Our guests are people who are involved with a program at California State University Fresno to help reduce recidivism and help ex-inmates turn their lives around to become contributing members of society. Our guests are California State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes, Jennifer Leahy, the director of Fresno State's Project Rebound, and one of its graduates, Arnold Trevino. Welcome to the Manny Report Valley Views Edition.
Thank you.
So Emma,
Thanks for
being here. So, Professor Hughes, let me start with you first. Let's talk a little bit about recidivism. You've been involved with programs to help ex-inmates. What does your research show are the kind of the best approaches to reduce recidivism?
Well, really, across the board, there are certain types of programs that stand out as being effective. The cognitive behavioral therapy programs are really popular. Those are ones that try and change thinking patterns in order to change behavioral outcomes. So those are effective. Those reduce reoffending. But those programs really work on addressing deficits, but don't necessarily focus on building strengths and new skills and new qualifications. So I'm very much supportive of the education programs. The research consistently shows that education reduces reoffending. In fact, one study by RAND that came out in 2013 shows that those people who take part in education in prison have 43% lower odds of going back to prison after release.
And when you say education, do you mean what, getting your high school degree, getting a college degree, or how broad is that defined? How broadly is that defined?
So the RAND study looks quite broadly at all kinds of levels of education. So mm-hmm. that's basic education, such as literacy and numeracy. It's getting a GED and also college education. But those studies that break down the different types of education show that it's the highest levels of education, the college education, that is the most effective at reducing reoffending.
You know, it's interesting because if you look at the where the state puts its dollars in rehabilitation, they follow that logic. About 63% of the rehabilitation dollars go toward education. Director, I guess I'll call you Jennifer, if that's all right. Jennifer Leahy.
Yes, great.
Okay, Jennifer, the director of Fresno State's Project Rebound. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, do you see on the ground, you're working with folks, with ex-inmates, does education really make a difference?
It absolutely makes a difference. So that change begins inside as the individual student starts to redefine how they see themselves. So moving from one subcultural lifestyle that includes a certain type of thinking and a certain type of behavior and into a very pro-social lifestyle is a process, and it's a change, and that change begins inside as people start to take educational courses, whether it's GED in college in particular, and they start to see opportunities in their communities and in their future that they didn't have before for employment and for acceptance and success in their communities. We also see it after they come home in a very significant way as well.
Can you give me kind of our audience kind of an idea of the kind of backgrounds of the, you know, typical background that you typically see of folks that end up offending and then get out and are trying to change their life, socioeconomic? Do you see certain kind of characteristics with folks?
Sure. I will say that my population in the cohort here at Fresno State and in this valley, because we do actually work with students throughout the San Joaquin Valley, not just in Fresno. And their backgrounds are generally from low socioeconomic status. They most of my students come from impoverished neighborhoods and backgrounds. I do have a large population of minorities, a variety, not just one particular type, but we have more males in the program than we have females. But as far as age, I have a wide range from 18, 19 years old all the way up into 60s.
You know,
so that's definitely the widest.
Yeah, recently I was invited to speak at a state prison. Frankly, it's the first time I'd ever been to a state prison, and didn't know what to expect. And I have to tell you, I was very impressed with the inmates that I met. I mean, they're all trying to turn their lives around. They're all trying to, you know, once they get released, they want to continue with their education and be contributing members of society. But I found them incredibly articulate, thoughtful. It seemed like they took a bad turn, made a bad decision early in their lives. A lot of these things happen when they were teenagers, and they're trying to turn their lives around. So I think that's what a lot about what your program, Project Rebound, is all about. So could you give us, Jennifer, give us a kind of an idea of where it started and what you're trying to do with Project Rebound?
Sure. So it started in the late 1960s at San Francisco State. It was founded by Dr. John Irwin, who himself was a former felon and came home and went back to school, got his degree, his master's degree, and eventually his PhD from Berkeley. He was hired in the sociology department at San Francisco State, where he taught for his entire career. He was a prolific writer and advocate for those that were incarcerated and education, and how that impacted changing lives. It had changed his life and transformed him from his antisocial pathways into a very pro-social member of the community there in San Francisco. And he wanted to proactively help other people do the same thing, because he had realized that being provided the resources, the desire, much like you saw yourself, Mark, when you were at VSP, the desire to change was there. The seriousness with which these individuals take their education is evident if you spend some time talking to them. But once they come home, there are still some very serious logistical blockages in their pathways to success. And so what Project Rebound does is address those things. Navigating your way through the higher education system is difficult for anybody who has a great deal of social capital and social support. For those individuals that have, and most times of their own volition, destroyed that social capital and social support, they come back into a community with a desire to change and without the resources or the connections to make that change possible. And what Project Rebound does primarily is work on a one-on-one basis with individuals, helping connect them to the resources that they need to be successful, helping them with logistical issues like applying for college, for financial aid, cleaning up academic records, cleaning up legal records. There have been a lot of changes in the state of California pertaining to criminal records, and we have legalized marijuana now, so individuals can go back and get those charges removed off of their record to help remove those barriers to employment and success. And so we do a variety of things. It would take much longer than half an hour to tell you specifically those things. But as a rule, we connect the resource that is generally already established on campus or in the community to the need of the student.
So it's more than just, you know, a student looking to get a college education. You help them with other kinds of services as well?
Well, absolutely. You can't get a college education if you don't know where your next meal is coming from or where you're going to lay your head that night. If you're still struggling with substance abuse issues, issues or child custody issues, if you have financial trouble in that you've gotten a student loan before and now that is in default, you need to get that loan straightened out and get back on a correct pathway. But also we provide an environment that supports each other. This whole program was founded on the concept of each one teach one. So our students take leadership roles in helping other individuals, in mentoring, and sharing information, and building a pro-social community, an academically minded pro-social community.
So it sounds like it's kind of a comprehensive approach. You're providing this each one teach one kind of a social network to help them be more successful. So they're in with the right crowd. Frankly, people are trying to do the same thing. And you're also, providing this array of services and how to access them. And that's one of the problems sometimes, just people coming out. It's not simply give someone a bus ticket when they got out of prison and good luck. You're providing a kind of a full opportunity for them to kind of reintegrate into society successfully. Is that the idea?
That is correct. So I know that you spoke with the individuals from LAO and in looking at their report.
Right.
They identified eight areas that were significant in contributing to the recidivism rate, and Project Rebound does address several of those specific areas, like substance use and leisure and recreational activities, and making sure that individuals are involved together in very positive ways that avoids criminal activity and involvement, focusing on school and work-specific issues. We help with tutoring and those types of issues that any student faces.
Yeah.
Family and marital status, we have connections in the community that help individuals with counseling, navigating child custody issues, et cetera, avoiding antisocial relationships and promoting that mentorship with individuals that Arnold can share more about that specifically and how that has manifested for him too. And changing the way people think. You know, we provide an academic course. Dr. Hughes could probably speak more to this specifically, our CRIM 136T class, which really looks at specific issues like desistance and transformational programming and the research to support those types of things to change the way individuals think about where they have been and where they are going.
So the importance here is that, you know, you're not just willy-nilly creating this program. You're actually looking at kind of the significant criminal risk factors that were articulated, for example, in the LAO report, and saying, okay, we're going to put programs around this to get these folks on the right path. That's what it sounds like.
Absolutely. And again, LAO report pointed out some that, like, the three key principles for rehabilitation programs to reduce recidivism. And they suggested that it be evidence-based, right, that it be cost-effective, and that it focus on the highest risk and the highest need individuals. And Project Rebound does that.
Yeah.
We are evidence-based. The San Francisco Project Rebound has been in operation for 50 years. They have an exceptionally high graduation rate, between 90 and 95% graduation rate, and an exceptionally low recidivism rate, which is between 2 and 3% for anybody who's even participated in the program at any point. So definitely evidence-based, cost-effective. We use the resources that are already established. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just connecting people with resources that they are unaware of in their own community, here on campus and in the community. And we do focus on the highest risk and the highest need individuals, the students. Those coming home from prison in particular are the individuals with the greatest needs.
Yeah,
and the greatest risk.
It was interesting that, you know, the LAO cited this Ohio study that found that higher-risk offenders who remained in these kinds of programs for over a year had 8% lower recidivism rates. But then when they looked at applying these same programs to low-risk inmates, they actually had a 7% higher recidivism rate. So for lots of reasons, for success rates and cost-effectiveness, you need to focus on those high-risk folks if you really want to make a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Professor Hughes, let me ask you, what are your thoughts on this? You think it's a Project Rebound and programs like this are a cost-effective way to deal with this problem?
Yes. I mean, I think all the evidence points in that direction. As Jennifer's been explaining, you know, we're giving people a pathway to follow that is going to allow them to adjust back into the community in a really positive way. So if they'd begun education while they were incarcerated, and we've already seen that that is shown to reduce reoffending, then we're giving them a pathway to continue on post-release that can also help them address other aspects of the reentry process. And another thing that we see is that it's having huge impact on the family members of the students involved in Project Rebound. So, for instance, some of our students have children who are now thinking about going to college in the future because of what they see their parent doing, because of how their parent is turning their life around. So it's changing families and changing communities in a way that keeps everyone safer and shows what can be achieved, what can be done. And the students in our program really act as role models for other students in the program, for new students coming into it, for students who are currently incarcerated, our Project Rebound students, on some occasions return to prisons to talk about their experiences and to show how they have succeeded, how they've turned their life around. So it can begin to give more hope to people who are incarcerated to think, well, if they can do it, then maybe I can too. That's what ultimately keeps us safer.
That's really interesting, that the spillover effect. You don't think about that sometimes, but the people get into a life of crime. You know, their father was a drug dealer, then, you know, they just pick up that lifestyle. But if you break that cycle, then it's not impacting just that individual alone. It's impacting their entire family, which can be.
That's exactly right. Yeah, breaking that cycle is crucial. And we have this year funding from the Opportunity Institute to run Project Rebound at Fresno State. And the money we're getting is about the equivalent of having one person in prison for 1 year in California. It costs about $75,000 plus, actually, to keep someone in prison. So with that kind of money, you can actually offer a lot of services that help many people.
You know, you can send someone to prison, or you can send someone to Harvard. It's about the same expense, which is a better use of dollars. Well, up next, we're going to talk to an ex-inmate who graduated from Project Rebound. What does he think of the program? Did it reduce his need to go back into, you know, I got to cut that. I got to redo that. I just completely screwed that up. Sorry. Let me just do that again. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, up next, we're going to talk to an ex-inmate who graduated from Project Rebound. What does he think of the program? Did it work for him? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We've been talking about a Valley program, Project Rebound, to help reoffending individuals reenter society successfully with two California State University professors, Emma Hughes and Jennifer Leahy. We're now being joined by a graduate of that program, Arnold Trevino. Welcome to the Matty Report, Arnold.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you end up in the criminal justice system?
Well, briefly, I started at 15, started
drinking, and from drinking it just led me to all the other gateway drugs, and with drinking came fights, and with fights came women, with women came more fights, and so it just escalated. At 16, I got my first knife fight, and I lost that. I got stabbed in the chest, and by the time I was 17, I was introduced to cocaine and heroin, and by the end of my 17th year of living, I had started mixing the two drugs together and shooting up speedballs, and so my life wouldn't, nothing would change for the next couple of years following that. I was just a straight knucklehead, living life of the day and nothing more. I finally turned 21, and I tried to go back to school, and so I started working the graveyard shift to pay for my tuition, and well, it was payday, and we got together for a party. I called in sick that day, and so I started shooting up early during the day and drinking, and as I would have it, I picked another fight at a party, and I lost the fight. I got pretty pissed off, and I came back an hour later, and I stabbed the guy that I got in a fight with earlier, and he ended up dying 5 minutes later, unfortunately. 6 months later, I was convicted of second-degree murder. I was given a 15-year-to-life sentence for the murder and one more for the knife. Out of the 16-year-to-life sentence, I served 25 years. I paroled in 2011. I gave the system an additional 5 years on parole. This April will be 2 years that I've been off parole. So that's how I got.
Yeah, you can see a series of bad decisions and ends you up in prison. But what the amazing thing is, you've gotten off that path. You've turned your life around. How did education play a role for you while you were in prison?
So I was in prison up until when I first started. The first 5 years, it was just complete insanity. Nothing had changed in my life. I was finally transferred over from a level 4 maximum security prison to a level 3 at Dual Vocational Institution back in 1991. I got involved with the high school independent study program there, which I graduated a year later. And I continued on. There was a college program there, and the professors from San Joaquin Delta College would come in and teach. And by 1994, then President Bill Clinton enacted a bill, the crime bill, which took away the Pell Grants from prisons. And I was fortunate enough to have graduated, and I was the last of two students who did get their associate's degree before that bill was finally implemented. From there, you know, it just education allowed me to see different the whole world view from an academic lens.
So
you know, and it just totally changed my life.
So you get out of prison, and I assume you hooked up with Project Rebound. Maybe while you were still in prison, you made that connection. And what happened with that program for you? How did it work for you?
Well, I got into the Fresno State. I transferred over to Fresno State eventually, and I signed up for the social work program, and they have 1 year of core classes. The second year, you have to do an internship, and it was during the internship phase that I had my problems, where I was told that I had to get an internship in order to graduate and get my undergrad degree. Well, during the summer between when the field director was looking for internships for all her students, they couldn't find one for me because of my background. Mm-hmm. And she called me up and she said, you know what, you're probably going to have to find a different major because I can't find anything for you for social work. And 2 days later, she called me again. She says, hey, guess what? There's a new program starting here on campus called Project Rebound. Are you interested? All they want is somebody that has a background. And I said, well, you know what? I have that qualification. You bet. And since then, it's been a blessing. You know, it just, I was a fish literally out of water, and the Project Rebound threw me back in the pool. And I'm talking about a pool. They threw me back in the water, and this water turned out to be an ocean. I have not reached the depths. I have not reached the ends. I'm just still swimming. And the funny thing about it is I don't know how to swim, but the Project Rebound has been keeping me afloat. You bet.
No, it's it.
And I'm currently where I'm at now. I'm in the master's program because of Project Rebound, and I thank them a lot. They really kept me going academically, and I'm currently also interning at the Juvenile Justice Campus here in Fresno. It's a juvenile hall. I work with Focus Forward, and I'm also at Avenal State Prison, working as a volunteer, the co-facilitator for a program called Inside Garden Program. And I'm still here at the Fresno State campus at the Project Rebound as student assistant.
So you're working toward your master's degree in social work?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and so that's an amazing story. And it's interesting when you're talking about the issues you've confronted, all the hurdles. You know, we want people, you know, to turn their lives around, right, after prison. And yet we put all these hurdles in their way. So, well, you were convicted of something. You can't get a job here. You can't get a job there. And that makes it almost impossible to get back on the right path. It sounds like Project Rebound really helped open some doors for you.
Oh, you bet. They sure have. And, you know, what does society want? Do they want the old me or do they want the new me?
That's a great way to say it.
They have taken me the way I came in. You know, I went to prison with one mindset, and I paroled with a different, and have a better worldview and looking forward to the graduation and moving on with my life.
You know, it's really interesting just hearing you talk. You know, and I was up talking to the folks at the state prison, inmates at the state prison. I was kind of tell you, I'm just a lay person, don't know much about the criminal justice system, but I was really impressed with the inmates, how smart they were, how articulate they were, how driven they were to change their lives, turn them around. And you are a great example of that. So what do you say to people, though? There are some people out there that say, listen, this person did a really horrible thing. Why should we help you? Why should we help, you know, convicted felons with a program like this? What would you say to them?
Well, who do you want? Do you want the old Arnold? Or do you want the new Arnold? I answer that question before they even ask. I'll share my story with them and where I was and where I am and where I plan to be. And there's over tens of thousands of people who've been released per year, and they're going back into our communities. And without an education, it's going to send them right back. And it's not sending them back is what we're worried about. What we're worried about is what they do to go back if they don't get that chance for an education while they're incarcerated. This program, and I enjoy going back to the prisons, especially on Saturdays when I do my volunteer work at Avenel State Prison, and I show them what can be. Change is possible through an education if you give it a chance. If you're looking for the change, it's there. It can be done.
You know,
once one, it's not always one.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, you can talk about to folks about, hey, this is what you should do. But when you have a living, breathing example in front of you, hey, I actually did it. Look at how, you know, bad my situation is. I actually turned this thing around. That's pretty compelling, I would think. Let me ask you this, though. Could you have done what you're doing without a program like Project Rebound?
Absolutely not. As I said, I was a fish out of the water. I did my first year of my core classes in social work, and they could not find an internship for me. I was done with academia. It was done. It was time for me to look for work or something else. Had it not been for Project Rebound, keeping me afloat, yeah, it's Project Rebound is definitely a worthy cause, worthy program.
Well, you know, Jennifer Leahy, you know, you're the director of Fresno State's Project Rebound. You must feel pretty good about hearing this.
It's fantastic. And Arnold's not the only one. Each of my students have presented with a unique set of issues and problems, hurdles. And like I said, it's difficult to navigate this system when you have all the help in the world and few obstacles in your pathway. But oftentimes, with individuals that have been incarcerated, they are so accustomed to hearing no, and you can't do that, that when they come up against an obstacle, it becomes a brick wall for them instead of a speed bump like it is for most students. And so removing brick walls like we did for Arnold, and all we did was provide him an opportunity to do what every other student in his cohort is already doing, is an internship. I did no work for him. He did it all himself. My other students are the same way. If we can get the door open for them, they will go through with enthusiasm and dedication to be successful, to dispel that myth. They are on a mission to dispel the myth in society of that idea that once one, always one is not true. That is not true.
Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you being here. Jennifer Leahy, the director of Fresno State's Project Rebound, California State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes, graduate of Project Rebound, Arnold Trevino, and Jonathan Peterson earlier on with the California Legislative Analyst Office. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Mattie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Mattie Report, visit our website at mattieinstitute.org.
The Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Mattie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.